I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 5 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee. I'd just like to thank everyone for tuning in and being an encouraging audience over the last few years, and I'm sure you will enjoy this season as well. We'll take some deep musical dives together in the coming months, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of these conversations I've been having with some incredible musicians and music producers with you. We have a couple of continuing sponsors that help to bring you each episode this season. The first is Union Tube and Transistor, making incredible guitar effect pedals out of Vancouver, BC. My old pal Chris Young at Union has been laying stuff on me for years, starting with his prototype Buzz Bomb pedal about 15 years ago. Since then, he's become a leading light in boutique pedal manufacturers with an extensive line of pedals like the Moor pedal, the Lab compressor, and the Sone Bender that are constants in my recording world. Check out their line of pedals at uniontone.com. And the second sponsor for the season is Black Mountain Thumb Picks. I've been using these myself for several months, and I think they're great. Cole McBride, the owner, is trying to make everybody happy and now has medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz tipped, left-handed, and regular and extra tight spring tensions available. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. So even though I've been doing this podcast for about 5 years, my heart just isn't into hounding companies for advertising dollars. So as always, this show mostly relies on listener support to keep going. And thanks to everyone that has done that in the past, it's a huge help to know that there's people out there willing to kick in to make it all possible. So if you're interested in doing so, there's a few simple ways to help out. First of all, please just tell your music nerd pals about this show. Word of mouth is probably the best way to get the show heard more. If you're in a position to kick in a bit financially, you can make a one-time donation or join in on my Patreon account, which is a monthly donation billed directly to your credit card at any amount of your choice. You'll also get access through Patreon to some private videos and other stuff as I make it available. And the third way that you can help out is to buy a t-shirt or other swag as it comes available. You can have a look at those or make a donation or join the Patreon all at the new website, which is www.makersandshakerspodcast.com. And please don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get them from. And while you're at it, folks, don't forget to have a listen to our offshoot show called One Life featuring Jim Burns. It's a fun concept podcast involving live improvised music and off-the-cuff storytelling. I think you might dig it. And finally, please follow the show on social media. I have links to Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook all on the website, as well as a YouTube link. And that YouTube channel actually is going to get a bit more action this year. In the past, I've just put up links to some live performances, but I will be starting a video series this year about music and recording that I think you might dig. So please subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. Links are all at the top of the page at www.makersandshakerspodcast.com and at my personal website, which is stevedawson.ca. So that's about it for the biz side of things. Let's get going. On to this week's show. Hey, folks and music nerds from across the lands, welcome back to the show. This is episode number 110 with my guest today, guitarist extraordinaire and songwriter and singer, Ariel Posen. How's it all going out there? I hope things aren't too out of control COVID-wise where you are. Things are kind of up and down here in Nashville in that department. I just crossed the border to Canada to make a record a few weeks ago, and that was a stressful venture, to say the least. And I'm actually about to go up there again to go and play a festival in Canmore, which is just outside of Calgary, and it should be quite the trip. That border crossing is nutty these days, man. What else is going on out there? Oh, I made some records. They're going to be coming out in the new year. It's a new batch of songs and then a trippy instrumental pedal steel record that was a lot of fun to make. It was all done during COVID and pretty wild to work remotely with a lot of great musicians. Stay tuned for that. There's actually three different records coming out. It's just the way it worked out, you know? I'll let you know when they're coming. It'll be sometime in the new year. So today's guest is a fellow Canadian, and he's currently making his home in Montreal, the phenomenal guitarist, singer, and songwriter Ariel Posen. Ariel is originally from Winnipeg, but he's moved around the last few years. Man, that's a cool music town, that Winnipeg. It's not an easy climate, but if you can handle the winter there and mosquitoes the size of small dogs in the summer, it's a cool town. And there's always been a lot of support there for the arts and music. And I first heard Ariel as part of the Bros Landreth. Do you say Brothers Landreth or Bros Landreth? I don't know. It's the Bros Landreth, who are also from Winnipeg. And I saw them here in Nashville when they played Third and Lindsley a few years back, and they were awesome. And Ariel worked his way up through bars and local gigs in Winnipeg and has some cool stories about the places and characters on the scene there. And anyway, from his start as more of a sideman, Ariel's become an incredible frontman. He plays wicked slide guitar, sings his ass off, and just generally is out there making great music. He has a brand new album out called Headway that we get into the making of here today, and I'd encourage you all to go check it out, as well as his upcoming tour dates. And you can get info on all that stuff at arielposen.com. That's arielposen.com. I should point out that this interview was done a few months ago when things weren't really happening yet, and we talk a lot about the fact that there's no gigs. But since then, it looks like he has a bunch of dates coming up, so be sure to check him out at the website there. And he's really active with social media, so I'm sure you can find everything that's going on with him there. So now, without further ado, here is my conversation with Ariel Posen. Well, thanks for doing this, man.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you're in Montreal.
Yeah. Moved out here in August, I guess, when you could say cases had chilled out a little bit for a while. It was actually pretty good here over the summer. It's been kind of crazy again, so it was a good time to move. I was back and forth twice, so I did the Winnipeg-Montreal drive twice in about a month.
Oh my God, that's a haul.
It's a serious haul. But you know what? In the summer, it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah,
I always associate, you know, Winnipeg to Toronto or that drive in the winter on tour.
It's the worst.
And it's the worst.
That's the worst. Yeah.
And you know what? With some good podcasts, some anything to distract you other than keeping your eyes on the road, like, it was really gorgeous. The weather was just perfect. So
there's sort of a lack of information on you out there. And so like, I heard that you were living in Ireland. I know you're from Winnipeg. I don't know if you grew up in Winnipeg, but we can talk about that. But what's your trajectory over the last few years? Because I heard that you were in Ireland, and then I heard you're in Winnipeg. Now you're in Montreal. So what's the scoop? What's going on with, like, where you're living?
Well, it's all true.
Okay.
All the rumors are true. My wife has been in a position with school and with work the last few years that have taken her literally across the globe, and being a former touring, but hopefully someday back to that, and just a musician in general, I'm pretty portable, you know. I'm grateful that I'm in a position now where, even before the pandemic, everything I do is pretty remote, if need be. It's not. I don't have. Not that I take for granted building up a local scene, which I did my whole entire life, but that is kind of a lesser part of my whole thing now. So, yeah, we moved to Ireland 2016. I had been living in Winnipeg my whole life up until then.
Wow. What part of Ireland did you move to?
Cork.
Nice.
Yeah.
I played there.
Where'd you play?
It was the Cork Jazz Festival.
Yeah. It's a great festival. Do you remember the venue, or?
It was sort of like, it felt, I don't remember what it was called, but it felt like a school gymnasium. and it may have been a school gymnasium for all I know.
Okay. Fair enough.
It was also like 15 years ago, I'm going to say.
Okay.
So venues may have shifted or something.
Fair.
But it was beautiful there. And then I was touring with Birds of Chicago last year, and we played in Cork somewhere also. I don't remember the name of the venue.
There's a lot of good places for such a kind of small place. There's a lot of great venues. And oddly enough, it's the second biggest city in the country. Like, when we
is it really?
Yeah, I mean, everyone talks Dublin, everyone talks Galway, even Belfast gets more, you know, even though it's technically a separate country, Cork is the second biggest. And when we first found out about it, I was on tour in Australia, and I'll never forget, I got the call from my wife, and she said, I got into Cork. We're going to go to Cork. And I actually said, where is that? Like, what is that? I had no idea. Just, you know, growing up in Canada, first of all, we don't learn anything about Ireland, yeah, of course. And geography wise, I was just another person that knew kind of just the very basics. I hadn't toured Ireland at that point. So yeah, no, that was a great experience, but that led me to kind of starting from scratch again. You know, I've been a guitar player my whole life for other people, for bands, as a sideman, session guy, you know the drill. You play on people's mm-hmm. records, do tours for people, backing people up. Mm-hmm. And I had found myself, we moved, and I kind of had to start from scratch. I said, well, we got to make a way to live out here somehow. So, you know, how did I get my start originally? Well, I guess I just booked my own shows. And I hadn't done anything like that in over a decade.
Did you know anybody there? Did you have any like musical connections there whatsoever?
I had one connection, and an acquaintance introduced me to their friend, who introduced me to his friend, who was the singer songwriter in town. This lovely guy. Yeah. And I should preface and say that, like, I'm very fortunate to already have the most minor of minor followings in the smallest of guitar community at that point. So like some people actually kind of knew who I was, which was very strange. Uh-huh. But this guy took me, he said, hey, I'm playing a show tonight. This was my second night in town.
Yeah.
He said, hey, I'm playing a show. Why don't you bring a guitar and just come hear the show, and then we'll go to a session later. And like, I literally don't know what that means. Now I know, like at the time. So for those that don't know, a session, you know, it happens a lot in Ireland, is you show up and you go to a pub and you play in a booth. Like there's people playing in the booth. I remember having a pint with a friend once in a pub in the middle of the afternoon. And then suddenly two guys started playing in the corner and everyone just stopped talking and just listened for 4 minutes and 50 seconds. They played the song. Yeah. And then we went back to conversation. It was pretty amazing.
Different from what a session means around these parts.
Totally. So I go to this guy's show and it was great. And then again, it's my first time meeting him. I don't know anyone else in the band. And I hop into his car with my guitar and we unload his gear. And then we go to this other place called the Oliver Plunkett, which is this popular bar on Oliver Plunkett Street. And sure enough, there was a band setting up right in the middle of the bar, like drums, bass, another guitar player. And it's like, this is crazy. And he said, here's a basement for you, man. Plug in. Oh, okay. And sure enough, we played for 2 hours. And that night I met everybody. That's like the go-to musicians. They were all either on the gig or hanging out, sitting all around us. And most of the people that I played with or met that night are now some of my dearest friends, and bandmates that I use often. So it happened immediately. I was very lucky to meet everybody right away. So in terms of a little local scene and community, it's like, what I thought I lost from leaving Winnipeg, I just regained that in a new place.
Right.
And then long story short, I was doing a lot of traveling. I was taking advantage of being in that part of the world. So I was in the UK a lot, doing a lot of stuff in Europe. So clinics.
Did you have a UK band that you were using at that point?
I had an Ireland band.
An Ireland band.
Yeah, okay. Cork band. They're fantastic. One of them has since moved to London, but they're both Cork boys. I was just doing a lot more. And then my visa expired after 2 years. They don't have it's not like getting a P2 or an O1 or anything. It's like you get the one, unless you can convince the Irish government that there is absolute reason for permanent residency or something like that.
Yeah.
There's just the one visa. So I did that. And for 2 years, I was just visiting in Ireland a lot and then going back home and then visiting. And we didn't want to do a long distance thing, but it was the only way we could. So I was kind of homeless essentially for for 2 years. And then that wrapped up and we're back in Canada now.
Okay. And that's basically due to your wife's job. Like she's getting shifted around. Oh, that's cool. And Montreal, same thing. To do with her work? Nice.
Exactly. I've always loved Montreal, but it's always also been a place that I just go on tour, spend a day or two.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know,
so you ended up in Montreal like over the summer. So you've been there for 7-8 months or something like that.
About half a year already. Yeah.
Do you find yourself getting involved in a scene there, or are you just kind of like using it as a home base and just doing your own thing? I guess there isn't really a scene these days.
There is not a scene that I know of these days. I have basically kept to myself here. I mean, I have a little studio here where I do all my work. I've produced a couple records. I've started working on another record. I've been writing. I do sessions for people. I teach. It's all from here. I do have some friends here, and I do know some people in the scene. You know, I have done a few things at a couple studios, stuff like that. But in terms of, you know, there's no jams to go to. There's no open mics. There's no gigs. So that kind of networking or just hang thing hasn't happened. It sucks because it's such a great city for that.
There is a killer music scene there. Yeah.
And I mean, once things go back to normal with like the jazz festival and even though I have nothing to do with it, like the comedy festival, I just can't wait to take advantage of those kind of things. I don't even know how long we'll be here. If it might be another year, we might always be here. Who knows? But so far it's been great. I mean, I just love the city. I love that I can hike on a mountain right in the middle of the city. Food's great.
Yeah.
8 p.m. curfew since Christmas, but what are you going to do? I'm at home anyway.
Really?
So, yeah, it's crazy.
Wow. I didn't know that. Do you miss Winnipeg?
Yeah, I always miss Winnipeg, but I'm also so used to kind of having this long distance relationship with it now. So
yeah,
I miss it. And then I catch up, and then I go there, and it's like I never left. It's really the people. It's not that I miss the place itself. All my family, all my friends are there. I'm actually going there tomorrow, which will be great. Oh, yeah.
So you grew up in Winnipeg. Tell me about that and like when you got into music and stuff. And, you know, there's just such a strong musical output from you. And like when I first got to know your work with the Bros Landreth and those guys, but then there's like a whole strong jazz scene and folk scene and like all kinds of stuff going on there. And I'm always kind of blown away by the whole Manitoba thing. Can you tell me a bit about both growing up there, but also like, I don't know much about like what you were doing, you know, like 10 years ago when you were kind of like starting, what's your...
Well, first of all, both my parents are musicians. My parents had a band called Finjan, which they had for 30 years. And when I was born, like literally 2 months old, I was already on a plane just going
really?
To gigs. Yeah.
Yeah. You're one of those kids.
Yeah. Yeah. just immersed in, you know, folk festivals, jazz festivals, theater shows, this, that, parents being random.
What kind of band was that?
It was like folk meets klezmer, meets jazz, meets world music. My dad plays bass, upright bass, sings. My mom plays piano, but in the band she plays accordion and sings.
Okay.
And it's a fantastic band. So I just grew up with that, being immersed in that. And also my dad was a producer at CBC for 30 years. He ran a show called After Hours. And
what's his name?
Kinsey Posen.
I know that show well. That's right. Okay. So that's your dad. That's crazy.
That's his baby. Yeah. So I grew up between those two worlds. You know, they traveled a lot, but they always had day jobs. So they were always home most of the time. It was just like the odd every weekend they'd leave and we'd stay with our grandparents. And then in the summers we'd go do the festival circuit and turn it into a family trip, which was awesome.
Yeah.
And then I started playing when I was about 7 or 8, started on piano and then switched over to guitar when around the time that Beatles Anthology came out, which was like 94, 95. And my parents are big Beatles heads. So they kind of like, you know what? You have to watch this. And changed my life, my brother's life too. He's not he's very musical. He's not a musician, but we were both just like, okay, so this is the end all of all music. You know, like this is like, that's how we were brought up. And that's how I still feel. I just feel like they're the best. And it's all personal choice, of course, but.
That was a really deep thing that came out too. Like that video, that series that came out.
So extensive.
Oh my God.
So extensive. Perfect way to get to know a band and get to know.
Was that your first exposure to the Beatles and that kind of music?
It was.
Okay.
And I think it was the greatest way ever because, you know, my parents are obviously everyone that grew up in that time is going to have a different experience. Some people, I'm just referring strictly to the Beatles, but you know, my parents at the peak of loving them was Beatlemania, like 63 to 65-ish, that right. The early years.
Yeah.
Come like maybe their most musical and interesting records, Sgt. Pepper, White Album, they weren't as crazy into those. They obviously they love Let It Be, Abbey Road, but those, there's a couple records in there which are heralded and considered their best ones. It's just not their cup of tea. So
okay.
So watching it,
they like the earlier rock and roll stuff.
Yeah, but that's just, they experienced that. They grew up wanting to get the haircut, wanting to get the boots, wanting to get the everything, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what had the most impact. This kind of the same way that around the same time, this is totally different, but the same way, like mid-90s, what was some of the most popular music? It was just rock music, guitar-oriented rock music. Green Day, Nirvana, Rage Against the Machine, Red Hot Chili Peppers.
And were you into all that stuff? You must have been, right?
I was huge into that stuff because that's what everyone in school who started playing guitar wanted to learn.
Was that your first experience playing guitar? Was like learning Green Day tunes and stuff like that?
Yeah, I was learning. The first three things I learned, I think, was Pretty Woman, this song called Bomb Track by Rage Against the Machine.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that Green Day song, Basket Case.
Right.
And do you remember Kids in the Hall?
Yeah, of course.
So the theme song of Kids in the Hall.
The Shadowy Men.
Shows my Canadian-ness. Yes, exactly. Yeah. What attracted me to guitar was guitar being part of an ensemble rather than guitar players. I didn't get into that whole world until quite late, like when I was 16 or so. You know, and when I started playing guitar, I really took a liking to it. Like I kind of just played all day, learning songs, learning. I wasn't trying to become amazing or become like really sophisticated sounding. I just really enjoyed playing it. And it's, you know, all the friends at school that were playing too, their parents all bought them cooler guitars than the one I had. I was the only one left playing and kept going. And then fast forward, when I was about 16 or so, I remember I had this moment of, I think I've said all I can on the guitar, which is so dumb and hilarious, but I was just not inspired anymore. I wasn't motivated. I don't think I was listening to the right music to motivate me. My head was in a lot of other places. And I remember I had this moment where I was just like, you know what? I'm going to try learning to play drums and spend more time with drums. So I did that for about a month. And then at that age, that's the first time I heard Scuttlebutt. And then obviously the whole record, Couldn't Stand the Weather, Stevie Ray Vaughan. And the first time I heard that, like most people, it knocked me on the floor.
Scuttlebutt was the one for me too. Holy shit.
Something about it where it's aggressive, but pristine and elegant.
It's also, as mind-boggling as that piece of music is, technically, it's also like not impossible to wrap your head around what he's doing.
True. It's like accessible, but I mean, understanding it on paper, that is there. But I mean, he's one of the most replicated or attempted to be replicated type of players too, where it's amazing how someone so influential can influence so many, but no one really can do it the same way.
Yeah.
It's so much of a heart and soul type of thing. But hearing that for the first time made me realize, holy shit,
this
is
what
I needed to hear.
Right.
Not only am I back into it, but like, I need to put some serious work into it. Like I need to put my head.
So growing up in the 90s, like Stevie Ray had just never entered your consciousness.
Never.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, I just grew up in a scene where it was, and again, I wasn't in a scene. I was just a kid.
Yeah.
I was a 10, 11, 12 year old who was watching wrestling and playing basketball with my friends and, you know, the odd time. At that point, when I was 11 or 12, if my parents were doing shows, I had already taken that for granted.
Right.
And it was just a thing that.
Sound check.
Yeah. Sound check. Do we have to come? You know? So when I first heard that, it made me realize, okay, there's this whole other world of musicianship that this is like a pivotal moment. Like, do I want to take this seriously? It just inspired me. And right from that, like from there on in, it's like I put my head down, started practicing and learning, and then never looked up. You know, that led me to all the other blues, like obviously B.B. King, Eric Clapton. And I had heard stuff like that before. I heard Clapton and B.B. and Jimmy, obviously, but it never fully resonated with me until I heard Stevie.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you know, Robin Ford, and heard Robin Ford. And it was like, what's all that jazzy stuff he's playing? Mm-hmm. And then, well, I guess I got to learn about that. And I got really into jazz. you know, luckily my dad has this whole catalog of stuff and wealth of knowledge. And
what kind of jazz was really knocking you out?
Well, first I started with just guitar players. You know, there was this first record that I started putting so much time into, which was that Lenny Bro and Chet Atkins Standards Records, mm-hmm. which is still one of my favorites.
Yeah, that's a cool one.
Where they're just the two of them and you can hear them go, yeah, Chet, yeah, stuff like that. It's so fun and it's just so amazing.
Were you aware of Lenny Bro being a Winnipegger? Was that a thing that you grew up with?
I was, because my dad would always say when we drive down this street, Wellington Crescent in Winnipeg, which is if you want to go from Osborne Village to like Wolseley, you take this one. And he always would point out this apartment. Hey, Lenny used to live there. And one time he crashed our rehearsal when we were he'd always say the same story. So I was aware of it for sure.
Yeah.
Aware of him being there. But yeah, Joe Pass was a huge one. And through Joe Pass, you know, I started, man, Oscar Peterson's on a lot of his records. Okay. I got into Oscar Peterson and man, just the piano playing, Keith Jarrett. Oh, Bill Evans. Oh, like I just, and then of course I was like, I need to go farther back. I need to go to the beginning and, you know, Charlie Parker, Sonny Rollins, Coltrane, Miles. I literally bought every record I could, spent all the time listening, absorbing.
Did you have any friends or any like mentors in that way that were like hipping you to that stuff? Or was it like a total self-discovery thing?
It was a little of both. I initially got it started on my own, but around, maybe I'm getting my ages mixed up, but around like 18 or so, I finished high school and I went to university for about 2 months and I dropped out. I decided, no, I'm fully diving into music. And I started doing gigs. I started doing gigs when I was like 14, 15, mm-hmm. but I started doing gigs where I was backing up artists when I was like 18-ish. And I started to have like a little circle of friends who were all like-minded, all around the same age. And we were all like, hey, have you heard this yet? Have you heard this? Check out this new thing I'm working on. Whoa, cool. What is that? What about this thing? Have you heard this record? What, even like, you know, talking about gear, talking about this. And it was a circle of continual inspiration. Mm-hmm. We were all motivating each other to check out as much stuff as possible, as well as just pushing each other to get better. And we were all, you know, on gigs together. Hey, can you do this gig? I can't do it. Subbing out gigs, all that kind of stuff. So that weighed heavily into it too.
Yeah.
So as much stuff as I discovered on my own, I discovered a whole other sector of stuff from those friends and whoever else. I think that's the most important thing. It's like the more people you can keep in your circle, just the more knowledge, the more music, the more information you can take in, because everyone comes from a different background. Everyone's got, have you checked out this obscure Prince record? Have you heard this D'Angelo thing that was never released? Have you heard this Jeff Buckley thing that was never, it's just, you never know what you're going to step on. And it's amazing.
Did the jazz obsession at that age, did it ever lead to you doing jazz? Like, were you ever actually at the point where you were playing jazz gigs comfortably?
Yeah. I don't consider myself a proper jazz guitarist. I understand the fundamentals. I understand what's going on and the vocabulary, and I love listening to it and playing it. But like, would I put my hand up to say I should be worthy of a slamming jazz gig compared to my friends who are actual devoted jazz players who also went to school? Absolutely not. It's just not, also not where my mind is at as a player.
Back then when you were like 17, 18 and getting like, and you were like really into Joe Pass or whatever, was it ever something that you were considering like diving in so deeply with, or was it always just like, well, I dig that, but I dig the Stevie Ray stuff as well. And well,
it was,
else.
Yeah, it was. And I think that those formative years of when you really start taking something seriously, you got to try a few things to realize what's the right path. Right. And I auditioned for jazz school along with a few other friends of mine who have had very nice, fantastic music careers so far and continue to do so. And we all failed.
Really?
We all didn't make it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was the best thing that happened. And oddly enough, you know, a few years, not even a few years after that, like I would be the guy that the dean, he'd call me for gigs.
Oh, yeah.
For college, which was very odd. So it goes to show, it's like it didn't, I'm so glad I didn't go down that path, because it's not it wasn't me. It's not that going to jazz school was the wrong thing. It just so was not.
Yeah, I think a lot of people just end up doing that because it's like they want to be a musician, but they haven't necessarily figured out what that means or how their path is going to, like they just don't have a path laid out for them at that point. So jazz school seems to be an avenue that's like available to people. And so a lot of people that I knew that were my age end up going to jazz school, not because they were wanting to be jazz musicians, but just seems like a good way to learn when you're at that age, I guess. And a lot of people are into jazz at that age. Sometimes I think it takes going to a jazz school to realize like, hey, I'm not cut out to be a jazz musician.
Yeah, I think it's like you said, it is available, but like you gotta be good. They like aren't open to anybody. People want to learn, and they specifically want to learn from professors that are there. And it's about building that network. The network and community you build in a music scene is vital. The one you build in a college or university capacity is the same thing, and it's a whole separate scene. And you know, once college is done, where do you go from there? Well, you have all these like-minded friends that are in the same position. You gotta like, they all stick together. It's very important.
Were there some teachers at the jazz school in Winnipeg is, but were there some teachers there that were particularly influential to like your generation of players?
University of Manitoba. I mean, the only guitar professor was this guy, Larry Roy, who in Winnipeg is one of the top jazz guitar players in the city and has been for, he's amazing, amazing player. So I was definitely looking forward to studying with him, and you know, he's a friend now, and we've been on gigs together, and he's a lovely guy. There was another guy in town. His name is Greg Lowe.
Oh yeah.
Sadly passed away a few years ago, and he's friends with my parents from before I was a kid. And he's done a couple records with like Jack Semple. Maybe you know Jack.
Yeah, I know Jack.
Greg is also, Greg was an amazing guitar player. One of those guys that was really into jazz, you could tell, but kind of interested in everything. He's the kind of guy that would put on a show doing just the music of Joni Mitchell, and he would fly to Vancouver and take 15 guitars with him in all the different tunings, and then do a show with Jack, which is like the Chet Atkins meets, it's just like every, yeah, guitar on stereo. I don't even know how to describe it. And then he would do his own thing, which was like fusion instrumental guitar music, mm-hmm, just a monster. And he took me under his wing. I remember when, mm-hmm, I auditioned for jazz school, I had a couple lessons with him just to help me. And I always remember he always wanted to see me succeed. And he would always throw my name out for certain gigs. Mm-hmm. He'd always recommend me. We'd do lessons sometimes, and he'd be like, at the end of it, he said, "Ah, man, I don't think I taught you anything today." Like, I'd be there for 2 hours. Don't pay me. I didn't
really?
Yeah, he was just that kind of guy. And he's such a great guy. It's so sad that he passed away, but he was very influential as well. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of great guitar players in Winnipeg.
Yeah.
Older than me, that I grew up getting to see weekly, going to play.
Who were some of those guys?
So there's Greg, Larry, Murray Pulver, who's a friend of mine. He's co-produced my records,
yep,
with me. He was always like playing a weekly gig. Who are some of the others? Now, of course, I'm blanking. This is what always happens. There's a guy named Pat Wright. He lives in Toronto now. He played in a band called All the King's Men. They played every Sunday, which was like a jam.
What were the venues that you were hanging out at when you were like 18? Like, was the Times Changed was there? What were the other places
Changed there? The King's Head was a popular place for music, which is this pub in the Exchange. Mm-hmm. That was where the Sunday night All the King's Men thing was.
Okay.
They'd have bands Thursday to Saturday. A place called The Cavern, which was under a place called The Toad in the Hole,
Was the Blue Note going, or was that like before your time?
Blue Note was just before my time, sadly. I totally missed that whole experience. And any of my friends that got to experience the Blue Note all experienced it underage.
Right.
Yeah, there's like the Bella Vista, there's Shannon's, there's the Cavern, like I said.
Were you ever hanging out in the like the big Dave McLean Times Change Sunday night scene at all? Was that ever your thing? Like the blues jam thing? Was that big for you?
The blues jam on Sunday specifically wasn't big for me. I love Dave, and every time I've played with him, it's always a treat. I've played guitar for a guy named Ron Paley for over a decade. I played in his band, and he would do a lot of event band gigs, but also had a big band, has a big band. So there'd be so many times where we'd be doing concerts out at the Lyric Theater in the park or a theater casino gig, and he'd have guests. So like Big Dave would come or Leslie Gore or like someone big or someone local. It was always, so Big Dave would do a lot of those, and he was fantastic. A guy that plays with Big Dave is my friend, Chris Carmichael.
Oh yeah. He's great.
Do you know Chris?
Yeah.
So Chopper is another one of those guitar players that I grew up watching and just being floored by. And we played in a band together for a while too, which was a lot of fun.
So,
well, guitar players locally, for sure.
What was your life like when you were like 19, 20? So you're gigging around a lot? Like, were you playing many times a week kind of thing? Or, I mean, Winnipeg seems like that kind of town, especially at that point, I guess, like in the late 90s or whatever. There must have been a ton of gigs, right?
For sure. This now was like 2004, 2005.
Okay.
But yeah, I was a yes man. I was trying to get any and every gig I could. So like I said at the beginning of this, how did I get my real start? I booked my own gig. So I had a band with David Landreth and my friend Paul Yee, and we were called Groovy Mustache. Best band name ever. The band was, you know, I sang, fronted. It was trio. It was mostly covers, obscure covers that I liked to play that the guys wanted to play, where we'd stretch out.
Like what? What kind of stuff?
Stuff from, you know, we'd play everything from The Meters to Stevie Ray Vaughan to Galactic to Frank Zappa to...
That's all over the place.
Doyle Bramhall, did I say that already? To The Police, to Little Feet, Lovett, a little of everything. Lester Kwitsaw, like literally such a random, eclectic mix of music. And it was a chance for us to make money. You know, I was booking us gigs, but it was also a chance to just stretch out, and people would come see the band and be like, hey, yeah, that band's okay. But do you want to come play guitar on this artist's record? Do you want to come play on this tour? Or, and the same with the other guys. They'd say, yeah, band's okay. Do you want to, we need a bass player though for this thing. So it was like an outlet to get more gigs.
Perfect. That's exactly what you need.
Which is exactly what we need. So I was doing that. And then, yeah, so more gigs started happening like that. Hey, we got this residency for an artist that just signed with Sony. She's doing 2 months of Tuesday residencies at Dylan's Irish Pub with the full band, full production, just so we can get her in shape. So it was just stuff like that.
Yep.
Do a lot of showcases. I wasn't really doing too much traveling at that point yet. I was still, you know, I would be that guy that would play a cocktail dinner thing from 6 to 8 with like a nice shirt on, playing standards, run into my car, change, put on slightly cooler clothes, run to the Pyramid or run to the West End, play an actual cool show with someone, and then check my watch and scoot over till the times change or somewhere else around midnight and sit in for the last two sets with my other friend's band. Or or literally sometimes it would be a real gig where I'd be like, hey guys, I can be there for 11:45. Can you just set up an amp for me? And I swear I'll make it there on time.
You roll in at 11:44.
Yeah, a lot of negotiating, but Winnipeg is small enough that you can get around.
And were you playing slide guitar at that point, or had that not, like, at what point did that start for you?
That started, I mean, I'd always played slide, like, just, I don't really know what I'm doing. I grabbed one slide at Long McQuaid, and it's hard. You know, I didn't know anything about setting up your guitar. I didn't know anything about the right slide you should have. I just did it. Around 2000, I'd say only maybe a year or so after that, I started playing more slide. I saw Derek Trucks play, and it was like, that was really good. That was, in fact, I was in tears, but it wasn't like, I want to do that.
Oh,
that was
interesting.
More, yeah. It was more, that was more like, that's untouchable.
It was just like, totally foreign as to what he was up to.
Yeah, we just need one Derek. That's fine. When I had the experience of like, wow, that's really speaking to me, was when I first heard Kevin Bright and Sisters Euclid and his records with Harry Manx. I heard that, and it was just, first of all, that led me to experimenting with open tuning, drop tuning, chordal stuff, droning stuff. It opened this whole world, and that's what really spoke to me. I just never really cared for slide in a bluesy environment. Mm-hmm. Not that there's anything wrong with the Delta blues kind of stuff. It's just never what caught my ear. It mm-hmm. was more this melodic. It was just, it just spoke to me. And I was like, I need to understand what's going on here. That really spoke to me. So that I started putting a lot more time into slide just because I was inspired.
So what kind of tunings were you experimenting with? Like the standard, like open E, open G, those kind of things?
Honestly, just other than standard tuning, I took a guitar and tuned it to open E.
Yeah.
And I said, if I can transfer everything I know to open E, then that's good enough for me. Okay. And eventually I learned that, hey, I can just be an open D and it's the same thing. Oh, I can be an open C. It's the same thing. Open G is a whole different ballgame. I just haven't spent time with that.
Right.
But I took an open E guitar. I had a road-worn Strat tuned to open E, and I started taking it on every gig that I had. Sometimes... Actually, more often than not, it was like, oh, I've made a mistake. What am I doing? How can I make sure the people that are hiring me don't give me the full-on stink eye here because I'm butchering their music. It probably wasn't that bad, but that's how I learned. Trial by fire, application. It put me on the spot. You know, it was like, okay, if this is my A major bar chord, now it's this. How do I change everything up?
Would you spend a night like doing a whole gig in an open tuning?
Yeah, I mean, any gig that was slightly more casual, like let's say it was a three setter somewhere.
Yeah.
Hands down, I would take that guitar.
Yeah.
And just
play that the whole night.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll teach you fast.
I'm just a guy that learns by application, by doing it in context with people on stage or in some kind of playing capacity. If I could sit there all day at home and, okay, so it's this. But if I make enough mistakes and then I learn from those mistakes in context, that's what really sticks with me. But I was already playing a lot of slide, just learning other people's slide parts on gigs that I was doing. And people would often say, hey, that sounded really good. Why don't you do more of the slide thing on this song too? It's like, oh, all right. It's not that I was hanging on to like lightning in a bottle. That's not what I'm saying at all. But there was something natural about playing slide that I guess other people could see that too. And yeah, eventually later I realized, oh, okay, so need to raise the action, need to find a slide that fits my finger properly. I always played on my pinky. It just felt right, even though Derek, Kevin, who else that I really enjoyed? Robbie McIntosh. I think he plays on his ring too. All these guys were ring players.
Yeah.
Bonnie Raitt, middle finger.
Right.
I guess Sonny Landreth is a pinky guy too, of course.
He is. But
it's just that I just went with what felt right. And then I started learning, so if I tune down, I should put heavier strings on and all this stuff. It just became
a process.
A process, and so many people struggle with it, and I know why, because I did too. It's a type of technique that requires a specific kind of setup, as you know. You can't just pick up any guitar off the wall at a guitar store at the NAMM show and just expect to go for it.
There's some people that can't. I couldn't play slide on somebody's guitar. I'm exactly like what you say. If I picked somebody's guitar up and had a slide in my hand, it would just sound ridiculous. I wouldn't be able to function at all. But given my guitar, it's like home. So, but there are people that can play really great slide on like a totally normal. You know who's incredible at that is Jack Pearson. That guy, he's just like on a normal. He tunes his G string up to G sharp, and then he's like ready to go. And it's just his normal Strat.
So standard tuning, but G to G sharp.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And he's incredible. And it's like, he doesn't skip a beat. He just plays one guitar all night and he's just as fluent on the slide as he is on the non-slide stuff. And to me, that just like, there's no way I could do that.
Wow.
And I know you use like crazy heavy strings. I'm in the middle. Like I don't use super heavy strings, but they're heavy. They're too heavy to play like bendy note kind of stuff.
Well, here's the thing, that I only use heavy strings if I'm like on a baritone or in C. So it's all about matching the tension. So if I'm an E or, you know, open E, I like 11s to 12s. That's kind of my go-to, just standard. I like a fight. I play hard. Yeah. So, you know, 10s, I think 10s just for slide in general are just too light.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of working up this ladder of like, okay, 10, 11 or 12s for E. If I go to D, well, then probably 12 or 13 would work. If I go to C, 14 to 15.
Yeah.
If I go to B, 16 to 17. And that's exactly how and why. So if you match the tension right, if you played my guitar, if I passed it to you through this Zoom call right now, which is tuned to B standard, and you tried to bend up on the B string, you'd be surprised. You'd say, oh, it just feels like normal guitar. Hmm. Because it does, because the tension is matched. Even though the strings are way heavier, it's not like playing, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan style 13s
right.
in E-flat.
Right.
Like, that's crazy. Or I have a friend, Josh Smith, who plays 13s in standard tuning.
Wow.
And that, those are like wires.
Wow.
And that's the kind of thing you really need to keep stay conditioned for, because it's a whole different thing. So this is, it comes off crazy, and then you think about it and you try it and you're like, oh, I see. It's actually not crazy.
So when you got really into it, you mentioned Kevin Bright, you mentioned Sonny Landreth. I don't know if he was a big influence for you. Like, it seems like you do enough of the behind the slide stuff where he was probably an influence.
Oddly enough, I never really got into Sonny much.
Okay.
I know there's a lot of similarities, but it was mostly guys like Derek and Kevin. And I it's about listening, taking your heroes for anything. Like, you know, if you like Stevie Ray Vaughan, hey, go check out who he listened to.
Yeah.
Albert King, Jimi Hendrix, Freddie King.
Did that ever lead you to, you know, get interested in the blues players, or did you just like kind of never go there? Like, as far as, you know, listening to all the Delta blues player that were playing slide, I mean.
Not as much. Yeah. All the other blues players though, big time, but just with slide, it just wasn't where my head was at. And it's still.
And then with Derek Trux, like, after having your mind blown by seeing him live, did you ever come back around and like sit down with his music and like figure out what he was doing to a certain extent?
Of course. I mean, there's a lot of things I've tried to learn that he does, because it's just so amazing. And the way he phrases things on one string.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Absolutely. And he made me want to go listen to Dwayne. And, and you know what? For such a legend too, it's like, it just didn't speak to me the same way personally. You know, I love Lowell George, Ry Cooder. Again, and I go back to the Beatles. There is some George slide playing in Beatles and on his solo material, obviously, which I'm very much into, where it's just unbelievable. In fact, on that Beatles anthology, they did two songs.
Those, the Jeff Lynne ones. Yeah.
Real Love and Free as a Bird. And one of those songs,
Free as a Bird, has that slide melody thing.
Free as a Bird. Such a great slide solo. And I remember seeing that when I was just 8 years old. And I think subconsciously it really stayed with me as it was such a cool sound and such an emotive way to get a melody out. But I love all those players. And, you know, there's a lot of slide players out these days too that are doing a lot, like Blake Mills is doing a lot of great stuff. Jason Isbell's playing really interesting, nice slide.
Yeah,
the list goes on and on and on. But it was, you know how it is. It's like you latch onto one or two things that really speaks to you, and you kind of that's your bubble.
Okay, at what point did you run into Joey Landreth? Like, how did that all happen? And I mean, you guys are probably around the same age, and like both incredible players, great singers. How did that happen? Where you guys hooked up?
We've just known each other forever. His girlfriend in high school was in my band when we were
really
15 years old, and he came over to pick her up once, and we met there. And then a couple of years later, I was on a gig backing up a singer with this guy, Dave Landreth. And before the rehearsal, he said, or someone said in the band, we're looking to fill one more, we want to have two guitar players in this band. And he said, oh, my brother could probably do it. I'll bring my brother. And then the next day he showed up, and I'm like, oh my God, you guys are brothers. Oh my, you know? So we've just known each other
forever,
almost 20 years, forever.
Wow.
So we just grew up, all those guys are in that same circle.
Yeah.
We all kind of grew up musically together, passing off gigs to each other, listening to the same music, being inspired by the same things, hanging out all the time, going to each other's gigs, just stuff like that. So seems like a crazy coincidence, but it's just your people that you grew up with.
I,
you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I first heard about you and saw you. I saw you here in Nashville. I saw you a couple of times before that, too, at some festivals and stuff with the bros, Landreth. Were you in that band officially? Or like, what was your status in that band? How did that all work? You were in the band, I guess, right?
Yeah. Really, it's an artist gig.
Yeah.
That's their band.
Yeah.
Just like anyone that tours under their own name, that's their band. It does kind of come off like it's a band, but really we're sidemen in that band.
Yeah.
I did do a little bit of writing for their last record with them, just on like a couple songs, but like we're just the everyone else in the band is just the band, just like any other sideman gig.
How do you approach, you know, like in that band, I guess you have to kind of leave room for Joey to be featured. And I remember that sort of like the first time I saw you guys, he was the one that sort of drew the attention. Like he was singing leads and he was playing more of the guitar solos and stuff. You were playing quite a bit of lap steel, as I remember that
night.
Oh,
so that would have been kind of earlier in the days.
Maybe.
I think for a year, half a year, I brought a lap steel out on a handful of which were some songs. Yeah, absolutely.
So, what's your mindset like with that? Like, as far as, you know, what you're doing right now, which we'll get into, of course, but like as a front man, there's one thing, but like when you have a gig that's a solid touring gig and you're like a side guy more, how do you approach those differently?
It just comes down to serving the song. Mm-hmm. It's not about you. You're there to play the songs that, you know, you're there to fit into someone else's picture, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that's their band. That's their songs. That's their parts. That's, you know, I'm there. I was there to fill in the other gaps. They were touring with the keyboard player for a little bit at the very, very, very beginning. And then that changed. So I kind of came in to fill in the gaps that the piano was, that the keys were doing, which is already hard to do because if you're playing Whirly in B3, you could have 10 guitar players in a band and that will never fill it up the same way.
Yeah.
So I came in, you know, trying to emulate some of those elements. And that's a big reason why the lap steel was in play at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then it became more apparent to just make it more guitar heavy, so to speak. So, yeah, I mean, like I solos were always passed around. There was a lot of parts. It was about serving songs and doing a lot of singing. And that was the primary focus on that gig.
Yep.
So, yeah.
And you guys toured all over the place for years. Like, did you eventually have to withdraw from that band, or was there a break enough for you to start pursuing your solo stuff more?
Well, there was a break. There was actually a hiatus, which happened right before I moved to Ireland, oddly enough.
Okay.
So that just worked out. And then there was a couple of things here and there, and I would do a little bit of flying back and forth. And then it just got to a point where it made sense to just do something different. And I was already starting, I already had my first album in the bag. Started touring and I was just kind of too deep in it. I was like, okay, time to, I kind of have to, like, it's time to see this through.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just made perfect sense.
Yeah. You guys were road dogging for quite a while, right?
Yeah. I mean, the year 2015, I think we must have been on the road for like 250 days of that year.
That's a lot.
I got married that year. It was very difficult. I do not. That actually made me learn a lot. First of all, I think all of us wanted to quit music at one point because it was a very emotional year. Like, we wanted Juno. There was a lot of great stuff. There was a lot of downs. There was, you know, I got married. It was great. But it was such a stressful, crazy year because you're in a van for 90% of it.
Yeah.
And once I started touring under my own, as me, that's stuck with me. And I think that's stuck with everyone who was involved in that. Like, just can't go. It's more about quality over quantity.
How does that influence what you do now? I realize this year and last year is not a good judge of that, but did that have an impact in the way that you think about touring? Like, do you do it more selectively? You do shorter term stuff. Is that what you're going to do? You know, when things do open up again, will that be more of your approach?
It has been my approach. I've been, like, before pandemic, I was touring basically since my first tour as me was 2018. End of January 2018. Mm-hmm. So it's been 3 years.
Yeah.
And it's always just been about quality and quality over quantity. Mm-hmm. And something we have now that we didn't have 6-7 years ago is just analytical research on your platforms. You know, right. You can really see whether it's through Spotify, whether it's through Instagram, Facebook, geo-targeted things. You can see where your followings are. You can see where it actually makes sense to go. So when my first tour in the US under my own name, this was before I had any agents or anything like that. Pardon me. I just picked major markets and I picked a couple cities. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go to LA. I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to go to Nashville. I'm going to go to Austin. But I know that I actually, for some reason, have a nice following in Charlotte. So I'm going to do a gig in Charlotte. And then I'm going to go to Portland because it's just random things like that. And I...
Because you're hearing from people or you're just seeing, like, in your Spotify accounts. Okay,
so,
yeah.
So, and I could only do this because of the way I did it, where I just flew to these places and I used a local band in each city, which is, mm-hmm. I haven't done that in like 2 years. But it allowed me to do it that way. But now, like, when things go back to normal, and before the pandemic, I was luckily 2020, I was able to do full UK tour and this full tour in Sweden. And the UK has always been a strong market for me. I've done mm-hmm. about 4 tours there already as under my own name. So I know which places are strong. And you know how it goes. You go one place, you come back next year. Hey, maybe there's 20 more people. You go back the next year. Oh my God, there's 50 more people. You go back the next year. Oh my God, it's sold out. Or on paper, that's kind of the example. And Sweden, I had gone and done 1 or 2 shows the year prior. So I knew that there was I had laid some foundation down there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's all about, I've said it a million times now, but quality over quantity. So now, you know, my agents look at touring the way that agents do, which is, how can we get you on the road as much as possible? How many places can we hit? But I still will try to reel it in a bit and say, well, do we really have to do this yet? Or do we really have to? Because I've been there. I've gone to Lexington, Kentucky with the band and played to just the sound man.
Right.
And then gone to Cincinnati the next night and played to just the sound man.
Yeah.
And yeah, I get it.
Kill you, man.
It'll kill you. A big part of touring, I get it, is like showing that you're on tour. Great night in Cincinnati. Anyone can make it look like it was fun if you show a picture of yourself in the van. Hey, we played to nobody, but we can post that we were here. People go, wow, you're in Cincinnati. That's just the game. But it's just a different thing now because I'm very fortunate and grateful to have, you know, a little bit of a following and a platform that I can depend on, where I put a lot of energy on my online.
Yeah, you're really good at that. That's a...
And that really helps get the word out. It's never kind of been easier in some ways to get the word out and just, it's all little highlight reels of, hey, this is what I do. But like, when I come to your town, come get the full thing, essentially, which was not popular 5-6 years ago. Yeah.
Do you, so when you do all that stuff, because those are really effective, you know, there's a lot of sort of guitar oriented things that I've seen that you do. Do you just film those at home? Or do you have somebody that helps you with all that stuff?
Yeah, I do it all at home, or I do it sometimes if, I mean, I used to be a lot more, try to get interesting with it if I'm on the road or if, you know, I'm hanging out with Bernie Marsden and he lets me play the Beast, Les Paul. I say, hey, can you just film 30 seconds of this? Or, hey, I'm meeting so-and-so. Can you get a picture of us jamming or just shit like that?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, I just try to, social media and like Instagram and stuff to me is just online promotion and highlight reels. It's right. Not who I'm not a Instagram guitarist. That's my platform to say, this is what I do. Here's a snippet of it.
Yeah.
Follow along and listen to the music. Come to a show when I come to your town. And you know what? I should also say that when I was living in Ireland for a couple of years, I would go to the UK a lot. And I started doing a bunch of videos with my friends at Anderton's Music, which is a big YouTube channel, but they're also one of the biggest music stores in the country.
Yeah.
But they have a gigantic YouTube following. And I would just go with my friend, Pete, who runs the channel, and we would just kind of act like fools, not take ourselves seriously. And we would demo the guitars and demo the pedals or the amps. And they still do these videos, and they were doing those videos long before me. But I have people that come to shows that say, hey, I'm here because so-and-so recommended you, or hey, I'm here because...
That shit works, man.
Yeah. Or like, you know, if someone comes to a show and says, hey, I'm here because I saw you demo that overdrive pedal on blah, blah, blah. I go, great. Thanks for
whatever,
coming.
Yeah. Whatever care. Brings you. Yeah.
Totally. It's all good. Because at the end of the day, everyone's still interested enough and it brings everyone together to the main goal, which is check out the music, you know?
Let's talk about your new record. Tell me a little bit about the process for you, like as far as how the creation started, what your writing process was like. That seems to be something that you're always working on. You know, I'm interested in what your songwriting process was and how it went for this record. Like, did you write 50 songs and whittle it down? Or were these like the first 15 that you wrote since your last record? How did that all work for you?
The first record, I had 8 songs and I recorded 7 of them. And I added 3 little quick instrumental interludes on there to make it a 10-track record. I finished... I think I signed off on mastering, signed off on artwork printing by mid-summer 2018. The next day, I started writing. Started writing with friends, started writing by myself, just started getting new ideas. I need to be in a mind space where I'm not working on something else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're the same way, but I just like, my brain cannot handle it. So once that was finally done, I was like, I can think about new music. And so we recorded this new album in December 2019. So it was about a year and a half from when I finished all the work on record one.
Yeah.
So between that year and a half, I had been doing a lot of touring in that time. So as I wrote more songs, I was able to kind of workshop them on the road and play them at shows, which helps a lot because it kind of gives you an idea of what works, what doesn't work, if it's worth doing. And I can't write when I'm touring. It's just all when I'm home.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And I wrote about 20 songs.
All of which you started gigging with between records?
Oh, no. I out of the ones I played live, maybe 5 of them.
Okay.
And I whittled that to 12 songs. So 12 songs are on the record.
Yeah.
Which is pretty high. Like I could have easily done 10, but I just felt strong about the 12. The way the process is for me, whether I'm writing a tune by myself or if I'm co-writing with others, if I'm feeling somewhat strong about the song or motivated about it, I'll record it, I'll voice memo it.
Yeah.
And then I'll do a full demo of it. So, you know, I'll program drums or I'll get a friend to play drums on it. I'll play bass, guitar, sing. First take of everything. Mm-hmm. And by first take, I mean, it's just not very good, but it's good enough for something to listen to and reference.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's something called demoitis, which we all know, which is very dangerous because you can get really attached to your demos.
Yeah.
And by me not really putting in the work, as in like, I'm not doing 5 vocal takes. I literally just do one and might be very bad, but it's enough to listen to it. It motivates me to say, if this song is good enough,
I can do a better job.
Right. Think how good you'll do it
That's a good idea, actually, to not be precious with demos if you're going to do demos, because it sounds like you do pretty fully realized demos.
I do, yeah, but exactly. I just don't see what the point is if you're going to do it the right way after.
Right.
If a song's good, you can get the essence of a song from a poorly made demo.
So did you write, I noticed a couple of co-writes, like you wrote with Murray Pulver, I think, on at least one song. Are there other people that you co-write with a lot, or?
Yeah, Murray is a co-conspirator. We've written a lot of tunes together, and he produced the first record as well. So he just has an understanding of who I am as a person and as an artist. This record, I also wrote with my friend Alexa Dirks, we had a band like in our early 20s too. We've been writing music for almost 15 years. Okay. She goes by the name Begonia. She's got a crazy, awesome solo thing going on as well. Mm-hmm. Two friends of mine in Nashville, I call them the Jasons, Jason Gant, who mixed my first record, and Jason Nix, wrote a couple tunes with them on this record. And we've been writing a shit ton since this record. And then a couple other friends.
How do you like to co-write? Like, how does that work for you?
I love it.
Yeah.
I get so in my head when I write on my own, and I'm comfortable writing on my own, but there's something about every time I co-write with someone, I bring an idea that's already existing.
I think that's important.
I think it's important. Like, if I show up and say, all right, let's try to come up with something, and someone else suggests an idea to me and that's what we write, it's not me. Like, it's not something that I might be a great song, but I'm not in the business of just wanting to take a song if it's good. I want to take a song and record it, perform it if it's my idea and my song. But I love the idea of like, hey, what do you think of this idea? And they go, oh, that's super cool. But what if we change that one chord? What if we change this lyric? And I'd be like, oh yeah, wouldn't have thought of that. And vice versa. That kind of stuff is really great. And it's just there to, the most important thing is reassurance. I think this is a shitty idea, but let me play it. Blah, blah, blah. And they go, that's great. What are you talking about? It's like, okay. I get so in my head. So I really enjoy it. First of all, it's a great hang.
Yeah.
Songwriting is so hard, and it's like working out. You got to keep conditioning. You got to keep doing it, or else you get out of shape. And doing it with other people, it inspires me. It inspires me to see how people put words together. It's inspiring to see how people hear music and chords. I'll be completely honest. The music side is always the easier side for me.
Yeah. You struggle with the lyric stuff?
Yeah. I mean, some days there's some songs where I woke up and I just had a full verse kind of written in my head with kind of a melody behind it. And I wrote it down. And then other days I'm just sitting there
staring at a piece of paper for 3 hours.
Yeah. You never know. However, for music, that just like that can flow at any time. Arrangement.
Yeah.
Everyone's got a different, there's no right or wrong, which is kind of the coolest part about it.
How hands-on with the guitar are you? Like, obviously, you know, what I hear in this record is that, you know, you're wanting to focus on the songs, but still the guitar is obviously a huge part of what you do. And it's kind of the focal point sonically of the record. Are you developing the guitar parts at the same time that you're coming, or do you write the song completely and then start working on guitar, or how do you deal with that?
Song is bare bones first, unless, you know, there's an odd, like there's a song called It's You, and there's a song Nobody Else and Heart by Heart, which all start with like a very clearly like guitar forward kind of hooky thing. And it started with that. And then I wrote the song. Everything else is like chords, lyrics, melody. Everything else comes after. In the studio, and then a thing that helps greatly is when I demo these songs, I start to get little ideas. Okay. Even if I don't execute them to perfection, they kind of sit. It's almost like putting your ideas down on something. That's what the demo is. So when we go to the actual recording situation, not only, hey, drummer, here's the drums I programmed. Can you kind of just do that vibe, but like do them way better? Hey, bass, can you kind of cop the bass line?
Right.
And then for me, it's here are the guitar parts and the sounds. Let's do that, but grow and maybe change it and do better. First record, I was so used to playing on other people's records. I didn't know what the fuck I was supposed to do on my own record.
Really?
It was so weird. I was so grateful to have Murray there because I was second guessing every single part and little nuance. And it worked out. I think I'm very proud of it. But this time around, it's like I had that first experience of like, what the hell am I doing? Mm-hmm. I was very sure of myself. I was very sure of the songs, mainly because I had more time. I had sat with these songs longer. I had demoed them like it.
Yeah.
Just more prepared for the experience. And you're right. I'm, it's not supposed to be guitar music at all. These are songs, but the guitar is my tool of choice and it is the focal point musically to get to put out all those textures and sounds.
Yeah.
There was a lot of time spent just dialing it in, getting the right part, making moments. It's all about moments and building a song.
So a song like Coming Back sort of jumped out to me as one where there's like, you know, you're sort of dealing with harmonically, it's like, it's almost like an old soul tune, but yeah. You've got those layers of like, there's fuzz guitars going on and stuff like that. Are those things that you have mapped out in your head as well? Or are you winging that in the studio, or is that all a studio creation, or, you know, what's the actual layering process like in your head?
Well, that one was quite winged in the studio. The demo of it is just basically a clean guitar playing clean, nice. Okay. Words in the verses, and then the choruses. I knew that I wanted these big these big downbeat chords, and then this refrain on the guitar going that was already there, but texture wise and all, like fuzz and all those, that's a very dense song. There is a lot of guitar tracks on that song.
It actually doesn't come across that way, but I guess there probably are, right?
I did a video. I do these videos on YouTube where I break down some of the sessions and I just talk about it. And I was going through that song the other day and I was like, geez, this is dense. There's a lot. And you wouldn't know, because one of the tracks has three overdubs, same kind of voicings, but like one of them might have a rotary effect. One might have a trem on it. One might be straight up dry. Those kind of things is what's going on. The key word for me is different. I always want to just try to do something that isn't what the ear expects or what's been done already. So many things just get repeated and we kind of can't help it. In some ways in music, it's a kind of all been said. So with parts and stuff like that, I just try to be creative and have fun. I get most inspired in the studio, and my team, who I always do my records with, are equally keen to chase sounds and chase layers and elements. So
did you develop your guitar sounds in the studio, or did you come in with everything like pretty mapped out, like strictly from a guitar tone point of view?
I came in with the sound already. It's essentially my live rig.
Yeah.
I brought in a bunch of extra pedals, but they were primarily just different fuzzes.
Okay.
I don't mess around too much with crazy delay and modulation effect.
There's an underlying echo on what you're doing. Like I don't know what your standard live rig is, but there's an echo thing that happens on a good chunk of what you're playing. Are you using an echo pedal constantly, or?
I'm using a slapback a lot of the time.
Okay, so that's what I'm hearing.
So if you use a slapback and you kind of set the mix a bit higher, so it's quite prominent. And yep. If you don't use reverb, it sticks out like crazy.
Oh, so you don't have reverb on the amp.
I use reverb insane amounts. But on the record, things change. So
right.
There's a lot of songs where guitars will be swimming in reverb, and then other tracks will be completely dry, but with the slap turned up. And it just gives more, it just makes it more 3D to my ears.
Do you use a tape echo, or do you have a pedal for that?
We had a tape echo at the studio. I think we used it on one song. What we used more at the studio, like other than my own pedals, I have a Victoria Reverberato, which I use all the time for recording.
I have one of those too.
You have got one of those?
Yeah.
Amazing. The big one?
No, I have the ammo case one.
The smaller one, yeah. It's so good. So I use that. And then we also had one of those old Fender Echo Reverbs, which is those oil can delays.
Oh, those things are awesome. They're a total pain in the ass, but they're awesome.
They're awesome if they work.
Totally.
If they don't work, they kind of suck. But Paul's, he's got his working. At least he had it working at the time. And that provided, you know what it is. It's just that beautiful, soft. I think of that kind of delay as like gloss versus matte. You know what I mean?
It's super 3D and crazy when it works. Yeah. But for anyone that's listening that doesn't know, it's like literally a little can, like a tuna can of oil with a drum, a metal drum inside spinning, and your sound actually travels through the oil in some crazy way and gets spun around by this drum. And it's like a trippy, it's almost like a Leslie effect.
It's a great pedal. I saw one on Reverb a few months ago and I almost spent way too much money on it. Just because they're so temperamental, I don't think they're worth what they go for. But
I've had a few Morley oil cans in my day and they are cool, but yeah, they generally start falling apart and don't work particularly well. But have you tried that Black Fountain one?
No.
Yeah, there's a company called Blood Noise Endeavors that makes...
Oh, Blood Noise, I know, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and they have one called the Black Fountain that's like a... It's an oil can delay. It's cool.
I got to make a note of that.
Yeah, it's good. I've got a couple of those. There's a couple different versions of them.
And that proves my point, too, that like these days, we live in a time where gear is so good.
It's true, yeah.
Everyone's, you need the old analog stuff, the Chase Bliss stuff, Poly... Digit.
I'm always freaked out by those. They have too many knobs for me.
No.
I just can't. I don't know. I work too fast to like really. I think I'd find them really intriguing, but when I look at them, I'm just like, I can't do that. You know, even their overdrive pedals have like 12 knobs on them.
They're very overwhelming. And MIDI and programming is my weakness. I can't be bothered to get too deep with that stuff. The tonal recall, the Therme, those delays from the Chase Bliss are just so good.
So do you find yourself like endlessly experimenting in the studio with that kind of stuff? Or do you just kind of like to get in there and knock it out and sort of find a tone that works and just go for it? Like how much time did you spend messing around with guitar sounds?
Well, I mean, we did all the beds in 2 days.
Okay.
And then we did a day of acoustics.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's a song where I'm playing my Rezzo.
That's a great sounding thing. That it sounds electrified to me.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's plugged into an amp.
Yeah.
And there's a mic on it, and Kian, the guy that mixed it, just perfectly blended it.
There's a mic, there's an acoustic mic as well on the instrument, and then
right on the cone, yeah. Yeah. The whole point was that the sound, like, what the fuck is that?
Right.
That was kind of the goal.
It's definitely a resonator, but it sounded mangled in a good way.
Spent 2 days on electric guitars.
Okay.
And I'd say that's pretty standard. I think I spent 2 days on my last record too. So it's a mixture of, it's efficient, let's hit it, let's go. But if something needs attention, if we're chasing something and we're not finding it, we're going to spend as much time as we need.
Although 2 days, that's not very much time.
That's not very much time. I think I only booked seven, like a week. Mm-hmm. At that studio.
When you're talking about getting beds done in 2 days, drums, bass, are you doing your parts? Like, are you doing keeper stuff, or are you just trashing everything that you do and doing it as an overdub?
I'm not sure that we kept anything. Definitely don't keep any of the vocals because I'm just sitting in the control room.
Okay.
Providing something for those guys to play to.
Yeah.
But like guitar sounds, I think there may be one or two little bits that we kept from the overdubs. The only thing is that like when we're doing beds, bass and drummer are in the live room. I have one amp plugged into one cabinet the whole day in another room. But when we properly do guitars, we throw four amps in the live room with five different cabinets to choose from.
Yeah.
You know, and like we put way more mics on it because we have all the inputs we need rather than having to mic up a drum kit, all that stuff. So just like how demos, I approach them kind of like, this isn't going to be the real thing, so I'm not going to fully go for it. With beds, I don't put my heart and soul into it. I just want to provide enough that there's enough for the guys to play to. In fact, for a lot of the songs, I do one or two takes, and then I'd say just play back my scratch for them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I could, because I was co-producing this with Murray, so I wanted to really just listen and be aware of what was going on. So
that's cool. That's an interesting way to work. So you did it in Winnipeg.
Yep.
And so was there a go-to like guitar situation that you kept coming back to, or were you kind of like flipping between amps constantly, or like 2 days doesn't give you a ton of time to experiment. What was there like a main rig that kind of contributed to this sound of this record?
I thought I would be a lot more experimental, but my main amps, I use these two rock amps.
Oh yeah.
Due to the nature of, you know, a lot of low tuning and a lot of lower register stuff, I need an amp with headroom that can hold its weight, that can push air, but is very dynamic. Mm-hmm. And those amps are just bad in a nutshell. Everything.
I've never tried one of those. I've seen them, seen lots of them, but I've never tried one.
They're amazing. I mean, you think of 100 watts and you think of a twin and it's like that pokey. Oh, first of all, it's 500 pounds. And
yeah,
how do I make this sound good if I'm not playing pedal steel? This is like 100 watts that's usable, and it doesn't even feel like 100 watts. It just feels like body and warmth and dynamics and clarity and mid-forward stuff if you're into that. Amazing.
So it's a 100 watt head or is it a combo?
They come as both, but I use a head with, yeah. On the album, we had a 412 cab, a 212, a 112, and we had a 15. No, we had an 18 inch speaker,
ooh,
which is on a song called Sometimes You Lie, just on the main electric. I used that one amp the entire record.
Okay,
except,
cool.
Except on that It's You, on that resonator that's plugged into a Victory V40 amp.
Yeah.
Every other guitar electric is that amp.
It does sound consistent, so I'm not surprised to hear that it was one setup.
I messed around a lot on my last record. I used that amp a lot, but I also used like this Benson amp I have. I used this Super Reverb, like a 68 Super Reverb. I used this old K amp. I love mixing it up, and I'm all about that, but it wasn't a sake of workflow and just rushing it. It was just, that's my sound.
Right.
And it's just so inspiring, and it does the trick. So I just, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Murray was co-producing with you. And then are the guys playing bass and drums, and there's a bit of keyboard that, although there's not very much, are those all like your core touring band, or are those like Winnipeg guys? Like, who is that playing on there?
Yeah. So bass is my core bass player, Julian Bradford. He's from Winnipeg, plays in my band.
Yeah.
And on drums, I flew in from Austin, JJ Johnson.
Okay.
And he recently just left, but he was playing in the Tedeschi Trucks band for the last 10 years.
Right.
Used to play with John Mayer, Doyle Bramhall II.
Yeah.
Oz Skaggs. I'm a huge fan of him. And we have a mutual friend that brought him out to a show of mine in April, I want to say 2019. Uh-huh. In Nashville, actually. I was playing at Lehman Drug Company.
Oh, okay.
And he brought him out, met him. Nothing really came from that. It was just nice little introduction. My friend came.
Yeah.
And I was talking with him a few months down the road, talking about my new album, and said, yeah, I'm really trying to change it up, this record. I have a little list of like some dream drummers I'd love to bring on for the record. And he just said, I bet JJ would do it. And I was like, what? You think so? Yeah. Let me put a text together and let's see. And sure enough, he was into it.
Wicked.
Flew him in right after the last Tedeschi gig of the year. He got to experience some December Winnipeg weather.
Woo! That's a life changer.
It's a life changer. but it was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful experience. He brought such a great vibe to the record. And
yeah, the drums sound phenomenal too. They're sort of like very dry 70s kind of drum sounds, that the snare drums like really front and center. And
yeah,
and
that's JJ. Keys, I had a few different people play. I had Alex Campbell, who played on my last record. He played some Whirly. All of the Whirly, he played it. He's in Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. Some of the B3 was played by a guy named Bart McKay in Saskatoon.
Yeah.
Fantastic producer, piano player. He does a lot of work in the pop country scene. And then on the first two tracks on the record, my friend Kevin Gastengay played on those two songs. He's a Minneapolis-based guy. And I know him through Corey Wong, who we've done playing and just hangs with in between. He's become a good friend as well.
Cool.
So he is like, you got your pop country radio style B3 player, your funk Minneapolis kind of
big difference
B3 player, big difference. Yeah. And then Alex, who's a song servant, just kind of plays very simply on the Whirly, but it's very perfect for the song always.
And as far as your, like the solos and stuff, you know, a tune like Nobody Else has like this wicked slide solo. Are you composing those beforehand at all in your head, or like even literally composing them beforehand, or are those fully just like, are you improvising? Are you doing 10, 15 takes, or is it first take? Like the way that you like working in that regard.
Well, I always say first take is going to be your best. We're always, if you're on your fifth take and you're still chasing what you did in the first take, it's never going to quite be the same. Nobody else. I had been playing that song live, so I kind of had a solo formulated that I wanted to do. So that was already kind of composed, you know, heart by heart. Heart by heart, did you see it coming? What are we doing here? Most of the songs I had done solos on the demos, but none of them were strong enough that I wanted to replicate them. It's You, that solo was written. Like I demoed that, and then I did the same thing because I just liked it. Basically every other song was written in studio. So yeah, like you said, first take, I usually come up with an idea. Might take me a few tries. And sometimes I'll go hard in the paint, you know?
Yep.
5, 6, 7, 8 takes until it's perfect. Or it's not even that it's perfect. It's the right performance and it's got that it factor or that magic thing. Because you and I both know it's not about what you're playing. It's how you're playing it and how it comes off. Anyone can play certain notes. It's just, can you say them a certain way?
How involved is Murray in that process for you? Like, are you sitting there in the room with him and is he kind of like egging you on to great heights, or are you
big time? He's right there. I mean, he's not telling me how to approach the solo. He just sits there and watches me do whatever I do.
Yeah.
And then once, if I might be struggling with an idea, like, I don't know where to take it, he might then pipe in and say, what if you go up here and do this kind of thing? That's where he'll pipe in. But he's very kind of like hands off unless he needs to say something. But it's great to have.
Great to have, good to have somebody like that. Yeah, for sure.
And you know what? Even Paul, the engineer, like I said, going back to Groovy Mustache, drummer Paul Yee, he's the engineer and owner at Stereo Bus Recording.
Okay.
And not only is he a great drummer, he's actually an amazing bass player, great guitar player too, and he just has ears of gold. So the three of us are sitting in there often, and he might have a great idea too sometimes. So I'm not the kind of player who's like, oh, you can't tell me what to do. Like, are you trying to tell me how to? No, I take all the.
You like it.
I love it. I'll do it as many times as I need to until it's right. I don't want to settle, but I'm also not going to, beat down a dead horse. You know what I mean? Like if something's, I love the things that are perfectly imperfect. I never want something that's clean and pristine and absolutely flawless. That is not what humans do. That is not what music is. It's all about character, and it needs to retain that first and foremost. And oftentimes it's in that first or second take.
What about your singing? Is that a similar kind of thing where you've got the phrasing, you've got the melodies all worked out, you're ready to go, you're just jumping in to perform it? Is that something you have to work on in the studio, or does it just happen quickly?
It's definitely not easy. It's recording vocals is exhausting, as you know. And
you do it separately, or do you?
I do it separately. Yeah.
Yeah.
Once we get everything tracked, I mean, we'll do all the keys and stuff. We're done. We ship those out. We're done later. First of all, before we hit the studio, we did like a week of pre-production, which is
okay.
You know what that is, but for those that don't know what that is, you know, me, Murray, and Julian. What am I saying? All three. We just got together at his house for a week every day. We'd go through each song, make sure the lyrics were as good as they could be. You know, sometimes a line needs a tweak. Sometimes the most common thing, I don't know if you feel like this as a producer, but the biggest thing we do as producers is cleaning it up, chopping away the excess fat, you know? So it's a lot of that. And that also includes a lot of vocal lines, like, we don't need to sing that we're along. You can just say we're along. You know, we've already established that melody. Why, you know, like let's make that faster. So things like that change. Mm-hmm. So when we get to the studio to record the vocals, all those notes have been taken care of already.
Right.
And we can just jump to it. And the process is I'll sing a tune maybe 4 to 6 times. And then we'll comp something together that we like.
And all the harmonies stuff, is that you doing most of the harmonies? It sounds like it's mostly you.
You're doing all of them.
Yeah. And is that's all stuff that you have worked out in advance too? Or do you put that all together as you feel it?
Some of that stuff is worked out in advance. Murray and I love background vocals. We maybe even more than recording guitars.
Really?
Like if you check out my first record, we went to town on the background vocals, almost like too much.
Yeah.
So much work for considering you can't even hear some of the little elements that are happening.
Really?
This time, there's still a lot more. There's a lot of background vocals, but we didn't go nearly as crazy as the first time. So we just love that shit. I demo these songs. I'll typically do three parts on the choruses. I'll add a three part on halfway through the second verse. Like the classic same thing every time.
Yeah.
Then as we go, Murray might go, hey, what about some oohs on this part? Or what about we catch this line? Or I'll go, hey, I want to catch this line, or I want to do a call and answer thing, or I want to do a, you know, and then we really have the most fun doing that. Like when we do background vocals, we have access to this other studio in Winnipeg called Signpost, and Murray kind of has free rein to that place. So we can just book as many sessions as we need without worrying about a time constraint or studio fees or anything like that. Very grateful to have that. So we'll just book little mini sessions. You know, background vocals are exhausting if you do them the way we do them. So we'll go in 3-4 hours at a time and we'll just do it over a few days.
I saw a post that you did right when the record came out just a few days ago. It seemed like you were implying or saying, I think you said that it was like a really stressful time for you as well. Was that a thing to do with the recording aspect or just like to do with everything else in life?
Both. It was stressful having to navigate putting out a record in a pandemic.
Yeah.
This was supposed to come out in September of last year.
Oh, really?
Bunch of touring attached to it. Yeah. But like, I don't feel bad for myself because everyone was in the same boat. That's all good. Yeah, it was just more so stressed me out of like, I put everything I had, not only into the writing, but during the recording process. You know, there was one song I kind of rewrote a month later and went back to the studio. We had to recut the vocals and I had to basically cut apart the entire song and put it back together in a different way. Some of the tracks, you know how it goes. Sometimes you get tracks that don't work for you and you have to pivot and try something else. With the mixing, some songs, I mean, Key and Reardon mixed it. He did a fantastic job and he's such a professional.
So you weren't around for the mixing?
No, but Audio Movers, not sponsored by them, but works great.
Yep. I use it all the time.
He was completely down for the cause, meaning that like, you know, some songs, I think we were up to 12 or 13 revisions before it was sounding exactly like I was hearing it in my head.
Yeah.
Just like the little particular things that no one would ever notice that only I notice or care about.
Sure.
Kept me up at night. I would.
It's good, man. You're supposed to do that.
Yeah, it gave me some gray hairs. Gave me some more gray hairs. I already had some gray hairs. Definitely possibly gave me an ulcer. And I feel like if you're not getting that experience putting together a record, you're not fully caring. It's not that you're not doing it right, but it just requires so much attention and detail and care. I don't know how you could do it any other way if you actually care about it. So, I mean, and there's other things too, just like, oh my God, this thing was printed wrong or this thing was wrong. Oh my God.
Oh, really?
Just little things. There's always been, as it goes, happens with every, but the whole process.
So if you shelved it from September to like, why did you pick now to put it out?
Good question. My manager and my team that I work with for distributing music, I'm not on a label or anything like that, but my distro team and my manager and everyone, we were originally, I think, going to do beginning of January. And they just said, why? Like, what's the rush? We kind of don't know what's happening.
Right.
Why don't you just do it in March? And we just kind of decided, we picked a date to give us enough time to do a big enough of a rollout. You know, normally you put out your first single, tour it for 2 months, put out another single, tour that, and then third single, maybe a week later, the album comes out. Since we don't have the luxury of the traveling, it's like, let's spread this out. Let's put out a few more singles than normal. Let's just try something different. So it was just about having enough ammo.
Is that what you did here? Did you put out one song at a time?
I did 5 singles, which is a lot more than I would usually do. First one, Coming Back, came out in September, Carry Me Home in November. What Are We Doing Here, January? And then Now I See in Heart by Heart, we're in February, just kind of like, we're almost there. And it worked out great. It worked out fantastically. It was a very interesting way of just evolving with the times, you know?
Yeah.
I also did a lot more content than I normally would have. So lyric videos, live videos, interviews, separate from like press, you know, just actual stuff that I can put out myself, just because I don't have the opportunity right now to go out and you know what? I was very hesitant. Like, I recorded this album in December 2019, had an epic January, and then I was in the UK all of February. Then I went to Sweden for 2 weeks with high hopes, played my last show in Thunder Bay, March 7th, flew to Ireland. The next day, the world shut down. I thought, oh, it's fine. I mean, things will be back in 2 or 3 months. I mean, I was taking off a couple months anyways. I feel so bad for anyone that was putting up music in that first month or two or three of COVID. Yeah. 'Cause it's like no one had first of all, no one was commuting to work. So I don't think people were listening to music, even if they weren't panicking from the pandemic. They just weren't, everyone was just at home. And everyone was just so distracted. A year later, March now, this is kind of a new normal. We're all kind of just used to our place. We're used to doing our thing. And I feel like it took a while for people to be able to listen to music again. So that was another huge reason why I didn't want to just get it out. A big part of me was like, yeah, I'll wait until life goes back to normal. But if I wait too long, I might not
dig it anymore.
Yeah.
And so do you have plans for the record? Like, as far as like, are you making touring plans or not?
I do have some shows over the summer that were rebooked from last year, which, not to be like a pessimist, I'm not holding my breath for them. And then I even have some tour dates booked for beginning of 2022. Also, I'm not holding my breath because I just don't know. All we can do is plan ahead and try to make a plan, but who knows?
I think you've done it better than most have, to my observation anyway. Like, you've managed to connect in a cool guitar-y kind of way, but also like getting your songs across still. And, you know, I think it's really worked for the way that you perform and the way that you're presenting it. It's cool. It's good to see.
Well, it all worked out. It's been a, you know.
You've been sitting on it for a while. It's good to get it out there, get it off your chest, so to speak.
Yeah, man.
Thank you for spending the time with me today.
Such a pleasure, man. I'm a fan, and I'm a fan of the podcast. So it's really nice to be on here, man. Thanks for having me.
All right. That was my conversation with Ariel Posen. Thanks so much for listening. And we'll see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. See you then. Over and out. Thanks for listening, everybody. The Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee at the Hen House Studio. Don't forget to follow us on social media and please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify Podcasts. And you can find us online at makersandshakerspodcast.com. As always, thanks to Jeremy Holmes in Vancouver for help with research. And we'll see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. See you then.